What's going on, fellow A-plusers? It's your boy Adam Perez back once again with another Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power review. We're set to go ahead and get into episode number 4 for you guys this week. We wind up getting ourselves this brand new episode last Friday on Amazon Prime. Listen, if you're not checking out Rings of Power and you personally enjoyed, say, the Lord of the Rings trilogy, I say certainly give it a try. I am kind of curious as to what the reception is for Rings of Power as a series so far. I feel like I've kind of been off the radar in regards to what social media is kind of talking about when it comes to this, but for myself as a viewer, it's something that I certainly enjoy. Like, I literally have watched episode 4 like literally 3 or 4 times. I think I've watched it 3 times, skimmed through it again on the 4th just to make sure that I kind of get all the details and hopefully make some further connections and stuff to the overall Lord of the Rings trilogy, if you will. And so, well, for me, somebody that has thoroughly enjoyed Lord of the Rings, or at least the Peter Jackson vision, along with the Tolkien trilogy itself, I personally wasn't necessarily the biggest fan of the Hobbit trilogies. They definitely had some good, some bad in it. But for me, I really enjoy just the mythology and the lore of Middle Earth. I've really have come to enjoy the different species and races and all the different variations of people that we see here on this particular world. And I've thought that the Rings of Power have done a really good job of really establishing history and really giving us a great sort of starting off point for this journey to eventually see where we're going to end up going to by the time we get into the third age. And like, for me, when it comes to this particular episode, another solid one, to certainly say the least. Nothing that really blew me away, but again, I continue to enjoy the character growth in here. I continue to enjoy some of the storylines that they have in regards to whether that be the people of Numenor, getting the opportunity to see not only Elendil, but his son Isildur, and really kind of see the beginnings of the much bigger story that we eventually get to. And I think the Rings of Power have been doing a really fantastic job of laying that groundwork. So when we get into episode number 4 here, a couple things in regards to characters that I want to focus on, and maybe a couple of honorable mentions. And so we'll start off with the Galadriel along with the Queen of Numenor situation that we see here. So after learning what she did in the previous episode, we see Galadriel at least addressing the Queen, really trying to get them to team up once again, right? Like, the people of Numenor and the elves were at once allies fighting against the darkness that was Morgoth. And so it's been years, it's been several generations since then, and Numenor has become very singularly focused on themselves, the world of man, not really making those connective tissues any longer with the elves. And so we do see Galadriel here really doing her best and her finest to try and rally the troops, right? Now that she's discovered this new information in regards to Sauron, she definitely wants the Queen to change her position on what Numenor has felt in regards to the elves in years, and really pick up their swords and ally with them once again. And the actress that plays Galadriel, I've gushed about her over the past couple of reviews, and I will again. There is something about when Galadriel gets to the point of sort of trying to speak in earnest, or really trying to get her point across, she just really captivates the screen for me. I feel like she just has this gravitas about her that really makes me focus, and it feels like there's a lot of power behind not only what she's saying, but she also understands her status, right, in regards to the elves and stuff, and how much power she does have. And so the fact that she carries herself this way, especially when the Queen kind of pushes back against what she wants, I really love seeing when Galadriel gets into her bag of really needing to kind of get the point across. And so the idea that she decides, well, if the Queen's not going to help me, maybe the King certainly will. And for me, this is where their story gets so much more fascinating to me, because the idea that the King has been locked up in the tower, the people of Numenor don't agree with his visions anymore, and so they've appointed the Queen to kind of live up to their expectations. And so the King's been stuck in his tower, and we get to the point of Galadriel wanting to speak with the person with the authority, reality, and that is in fact the king. And this was just a really eye-opening experience for me, because this really does show you why Numenor goes down the path that they're currently in right now. Like, the visions of the queen at the beginning were super chilling, seeing that huge tsunami larger than the island come in and just kind of wipe things out. You know, the fact that she opens up talking about the king here, in the sense of, you know, the king was once a believer like me. He was very strict on the idea of where Numenor was in regards to its stance of not really being friendly with the elves anymore, until his coronation. And she mentions the idea that once he had his coronation, his beliefs started changing. He became very adamant about, we need to work with the elves once again. And so when we get introduced in here to the seven seen stones, and not only what the queen sees, but also tells Galadriel, go ahead, put your hand on it. You see what I see. And Galadriel sees the same vision. There's a part of me that feels like the king probably saw that same vision also. I think the fact of the king bringing the queen to the Palantir, the seeing stone, upon her coronation, she's been having this same vision ever since. And I think it was the idea of the king wanting to show his daughter, the queen, or his wife, whoever, whatever the case may be. I can't remember what their relation is. I'm assuming it's his daughter. The fact that he wants her to also see what he's seen. He is taking the vision, I'm assuming, then to mean, we need to change our ways. We need to team up with the elves once again and form that bond. And that's the route that he took, and the people of Numenor rejected it. And so he's really relying on, I think, the vision that the seeing stone winds up giving him. And I do believe that this is yet another thing that works to Galadriel's benefit, because I think she sees what the vision truly means also. And unfortunately for the queen, it's not until the very end of this episode, where she's still adamant of pushing Galadriel away, that once we get to see her on the ship and leaving, that's when the white tree starts crying, if you will, or the petals and the leaves start falling, very reminiscent to that of what was in her vision, and realizing that her vision means not to keep the elves away, but you need to embrace them again. The idea of pushing them away is what will bring the destruction of Numenor. And I think once the tree starts weeping, I love the slow-mo shot of Elendil looking at Galadriel as she's leaving. They quickly make the connection here that that's why the destruction winds up happening. And so the fact that we get such movement, that Galadriel gets a little bit of an army, or at least an expedition, to go from Numenor to Middle-earth, is probably very earth-shattering from Numenor. Like, it's the idea and the clarification of what the vision meant winds up motivating the queen to go out there and rile up her people, figure out what it is that they certainly want to do. Do you want to go with me to Middle-earth? And I thought that was actually pretty telling. And so for the queen and the Galadriel storyline in here, I really enjoy how it kind of all came full circle by the end of the episode. And for me, it goes to showcase also how somebody like Isildur, how he gets to Middle Earth and really starts his journey, if you will, to eventually getting the Ring of Power for himself. And so I really love seeing just the stepping stones of getting to that particular point for Isildur. But it's really all coming full circle. And I thought the storytelling for the Galadriel and Queen of Numenor stuff was top notch in here also. And so, yeah, I thought that was pretty cool. What else do we have here? I also do want to talk a little bit about Arendir, the elf that's been captured by Adar, along with the other orcs over in the Southlands. We finally get the opportunity to see the face of Adar. I believe the elves wind up saying that Adar translates into father. So they are assuming that this Adar is the person that everybody is really looking up to, sort of their leader. And I think they're making the assumption that Adar is in fact Sauron. Now, this gentleman who seems like he's a little bit of a dark elf himself, or at least was an elf at one point in time. If this is Sauron, this is definitely sort of the physical embodiment of that character. And he even mentions the idea of not only having to mold and shape the earth, but he talks about really how he has high ambitions to become a god at some point in time. You know, he's like, I have to be a god, or I'm not there as of yet, but it's clearly his ambition that he certainly has. So, I mean, that kind of really lines up with Sauron to me. So I'm under the impression that this is Sauron before he goes on and acquires the power, the godlike power that he certainly wants. And he even tries to really, like, I am really conflicted with the Arondir scenes in here, because there are moments when it feels like Adar is kind of maybe recruiting him. Like, I like the idea that he starts making Arondir maybe doubt what it is that he knows, right? Saying, look, for generations, they've been spreading lies about me to where you really have no idea what you're talking about. You know, like, maybe if you knew the truth, you would think a little bit differently. And so the fact that he even gives Arondir his freedom to go ahead and pass along a message, there is a part of me that wonders if Arondir has now started drinking the Kool-Aid a little bit. Is he turning into more than just a messenger? Like, for some reason, it just felt weird the way he even delivered the message. Like, I know he goes on to save Theo from being killed, but even the idea of the message that he delivers to Bronwyn just feels sort of like, you know, I know he's directly delivering the message, so he's saying it word from word, but I don't know why there's a part of me that wonders if he's been turned, because of the fact that maybe Arondir has made him believe that what he has heard has in fact been lies. I mean, we even see Arondir with a very close tie to the orcs, you know, very tearful to kind of see one of the orcs that was in battle in a previous episode nearing death, you know, like, looks like he prays over him before kind of giving the final blow and putting him out of his misery, if you will. So I immediately already like the depth that they've kind of added to that, the Adar character in that regards. But the Arondir stuff will certainly be a wait and see, as he has in fact linked back up with Bronwyn, passed along the message that, like, you got to give up this land, or, you know, they're gonna go ahead and just destroy you along with it, sort of thing. So it definitely puts the humans certainly at risk to being just decimated unless they do something about it. But again, I'm curious to see where Arondir fits in all this. And I think the concern I have is just because of the fact that Adar let him go. Does he feel some type of way about it? It just feels like an interesting decision by Adar, unless he knows exactly what it is that that he's doing. You know what I mean? So I'm definitely going to keep a very close eye on that. And just a side honorable mention for the Theo character, you know, I am a little bit frustrated in the sense of this kid always getting away without injury or, like, death. Like, this kid has come across orcs, like, in the past two or three episodes, and somebody who is not even trained in fighting these barbaric and mindless creatures, he somehow has managed to escape. I don't want to say unscathed, because he has, you know, gotten a couple of cuts here and there, sort of thing, but, man, this little kid continues to survive just barely every time, and it's a little bit frustrating to see him kind of get away with such unbelievable moments and surviving these orc attacks. But he's to the point of using the blade proficiently, like literally to the point of, like, stabbing his own arm, like just causing bodily harm to himself, which thus activates it. I think the blood winds up activating the sword, I would assume, of Sauron, or maybe Morgoth, whoever this sword certainly belongs to. And it's enough to definitely stop the orcs in his track. But I do enjoy seeing the destructive path that Theo is kind of taking himself down, and I do wonder where he sits in regards to this, especially when we have the old man approaching him at the end, right? Like, I don't want to say this goes full circle, but this is the warning that the elves at the Watchtower talked about when it comes to the world of man, that don't get too close to them, right? Because there are some people, unfortunately, that still have those evil thoughts and those evil intentions within their veins, right? Like, the darkness is certainly still in their blood. It doesn't matter how many generations certainly still pass. Not everybody is like that, but there's certainly a few, and we finally got an opportunity to see one of those few come out and really show support for Sauron, and to the point of trying to get Theo to get himself ready, right? To even referencing the starfall that we saw, the meteor that came to Earth. A lot of people certainly seeing that as an omen. Clearly, this gentleman, also the Harfoots as well. And so he believes that this is an omen and a calling that a Sauron at some point in time is in fact set to return. So again, evil is lurking out there. And again, like, there's just so many crazy parallels. And I guess maybe it's just the way Tolkien wrote, just his forward thinking maybe. Maybe it's just the writers of the show trying to, I don't even know if it's the writers of the show or if they're really trying to pay homage to what Tolkien has written. But regardless, like, just some of the parallels that we see these days in our world, the idea of there always being an underlining darkness to people somewhere hidden, you know, and all they need is just a flicker of hope or a little bit of light to kind of give them the go ahead to creep out of the shadows with their evil ways. You know what I mean? And with the starfall here, it seems as though maybe some of the previous followers or those that still believe in Sauron definitely want to go ahead and gather up their strength and power. So they're definitely still in the lurking. And, you know, speaking, just to round off with the last group of topic I want to talk about, Durin. Along with Elrond in here, as we get the discovery and the reveal of Mithril, which I thought was a really cool discovery. I was wondering what it was that Durin and the king, his father, were certainly looking at, and now it's been revealed to us. And this is what Durin was under the suspicion for quite some time as to while Elrond was even back trying to speak with him and the elves, thinking that, man, maybe they must have figured something out. So we do see the dwarves along with Durin and his father very suspicious of the elves. And despite the conversation that Durin and Elrond have in this episode, you know, to still see that Durin is being motivated by his father, now that his father and Durin have kind of squashed any beef or there's a little bit more of an understanding, I'm kind of curious if the king did that just to get Durin back under his good graces to really continue to ask questions of the elves and be super suspicious, right? Durin has been invited to go out to the Elvish city, I guess maybe to kind of see how progress is happening on the tower, which is pretty cool to see that development has already begun to take place between the two races here and building that tower. But he really is going sort of as a spy for his father to see what other secrets possibly might be out there. What are the elves really planning on? As I'm assuming the dwarves are just a very suspicious sort of group of people and clearly have their reasons. Now, at least with their discovery, is such a very important mineral. You know what I mean? And so I do wonder if this is what even further slits the elves and the dwarves. Like, even looking back at the Lord of the Rings trilogy, you know, to kind of see the elves have so much mithril, whether that be their armor or their weapons, and maybe even the dwarves at some point in time not even maybe having that anymore, or having mithril as part of their armor and their weapons, does make me wonder at what point in time did the elves take over all the mithril ore? Did they somehow and kind of sideswipe them and really take that from under their noses? Like, I can see that adding to years and thousands of years of contention between these two races and species. And so I am fascinated to see how this is going to happen, because, you know, first off, let me just say a dumb decision by Durin to even give Elrond the mithril, right? Like, I understand that you guys are best friends, but you literally just accused this man of trying to discover or be shifty and, you know, try and acquire what it is that you've been holding dear to you and not wanting people to know about. And I understand that Elrond put his hand on the mountain and he promised and everything like that, but to just wholeheartedly give out a sample, be like, here's a keep that as a token of our friendship. No, like, you just don't do that. You keep that for yourself, especially when you're already that suspicious of someone. You know, him being a friend is good enough just to give me the promise, but I'm not gonna let you walk out of the cave cave with a piece of mithril that could fall out of your hands, or you just happen to showcase it to somebody else and then they wind up getting interested in trying to acquire it for themselves. Just a really dumb decision, man. And there was a part of me that just kind of rolled my eyes like, really? Durin, like, after everything you've done to protect this, you're just gonna give this up as a token of friendship? Like, no, bro, just the token of friendship was the promise. It don't need to be the mithril also. And so it definitely did make me scratch my head, but it's gonna be interesting to kind of see how, again, that trust continues to falter in regards to the dwarves and the elves. And another quick honorable mention in here, seeing Elrond use his elvish sort of tactics, or his abilities, I should say, in order to eavesdrop on Durin. I thought visually, I really loved the way that they depicted it. The idea of him hearing from miles away, or being able to see across vast distances as it like pulls out of the Durin and his wife's sort of conversation. I thought it was handled beautifully in regards to the execution of the elven abilities. But overall, guys, listen, I thought this was a pretty solid episode. Again, I haven't seen anything that's really like blown me away. So if I had to grade this episode, probably a B, but certainly still enjoyable for me. And again, I would be interested to see what the reception is like for others out there when it comes to the Rings of Power. Do you find it boring? Do you find it interesting? Is it compelling enough for you? Do you want more action? Do you like the character development? Definitely go ahead and let me know your thoughts of Rings of Power so far in the comment section box below. We'll definitely be back with another review next week for you guys for episode 5 of the Rings of Power. But until then, as always, do me a big favor, please. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. And keep it A+. I'll talk to you guys later. Bye.